Welcome to Breaking Banks. I am here with two good friends who have been regulars on the show, Brian Romley and Robert Scoble. Brian and Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brad. Great to be here.
And thanks, this Robert. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, you guys are actually, you're going to love the show that's going to air this week, actually, because we're pre-recording this for next week. But I had Ramez Nam, David Brin, and Kevin Anderson, three sci-fi guys.
Yeah,
talking about how this is going to change the future of this. So if you're listening to this podcast right now, you've probably heard that episode already, but I'm just letting Brian and Rob know. So what I want to get into with you guys, though, is obviously with working from home and all of that, we've suddenly had big behavioral changes around digital and technology. So here's what I'd like to sort of explore on today's show based on the impact of the coronavirus moving forward is, are there changes that are happening right now, behavioral changes as a result of use of technology that you think are going to stick? And also as a result of sort of the entrepreneurial spirit and investments that come from this, how do you think that might change the trajectory of, you know, where technology takes us based on the lessons we've learned from coronavirus or the memory that society might have? But let's kick it off with sort of the most obvious changes. Now, Robert, you are coming to us live from the Bay Area, but where are you recording this show from?
I'm sitting in my Tesla because I'm in Campbell, California, about a couple blocks from Netflix's headquarters. And I got kicked out of my house because my son's having this conference on Zoom with his school teacher. And my wife is on Zoom with her coworkers. So we have three conference calls on Zoom right now. Just sort of what's going on, you know?
Yeah, this is the challenge. Like people not getting Netflix working because it's under strain and all of that Zoom. Monday morning, you know, I had an all hands meeting this morning with the team because we're recording this on a Monday. And yeah, it was really sketchy because obviously everyone's doing the same thing. You know, starting off doing Monday morning meetings for all their staff. There's a lot of dropouts and stuff. So, but you're coming to us live from the Tesla. This is, this is what we do in this day and age.
If you think about it, they have really great microphones and it's soundproof. So.
Absolutely.
A new one. I mean, you know, if you told me on January 1st, if you said something like this to me, hey, Robert, by the end of March, your schools are going to close down and your school teachers are going to be working with you on Seesaw and Zoom and Google Classroom, I would have said, what kind of drugs are you doing? What world do you live in? Because it ain't the world I was living in it just 3 months ago, right? And none of us were.
Or even something more dramatic than that, that the U.S. was going to consider a form of universal basic income to bail out people from economic stress.
Yes. Yeah. Or that we were going to close all the world's economies and take a picture of it for global warming research.
I mean, yeah.
What kind of conspiracy theory are you watching? Here we are. And I think Brian and I were talking last week, and the amount of change that's happening every minute of every day right now is more than we would have changed in a month, you know, before this. So the stresses of change are real interesting to watch on.
Exactly. You know, guys, the rate of change, this is such an important aspect. I think we really want to kind of dive into that. The acceleration and rate of change has been so profound, so great, that obviously it's taxing most people's ability to cope and to deal with this change. The reality is there's going to be an after. You know, I call it the post-pandemic, the post-2020 pandemic. And, you know, we can use history as a guide on how people recovered, economies recovered, and the social norms that have changed. But, yeah, this shift in technology utilization, I think in many ways are going to profoundly change education. Obviously, we're going to start proving that in some forms of education, remote education actually makes a tremendous amount of sense, not just educational-wise, but financially. And I believe this is going to go from grade school on into university-level courses. continuity of government was, by the time you hear this, it probably is already enacted to some level. The Internal Revenue Service sent home most of their employees. And one must start to think, what does governments look like when it becomes hyper-local and decentralized, which I believe is going to be one of the artifacts of this. The theme is we're going to see a tremendous amount of decentralization and hyper-localization, something I've been talking about for a very long time, and now it's starting to make profound sense. Corporate headquarters are going to be a vestige from the former Industrial Revolution. The means of production were held in cities. It required people to be there to move items from A to B and things of that level. We're going to prove a dramatic increase in productivity by sending people home if it was done the right way. So I think those are some of the themes I've already garnered from this. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, you know, you take somebody like my wife, who we live 13 miles from her job, but that meant in the old world, driving an hour each way, right? So yeah. Now she has 2 hours a day back. And what does she do with that? Well, one thing we do with that, we watch a lot more Netflix. My friends at Netflix say their servers are seeing 7 times more load than they saw a couple months ago, right?
That's insane.
And I'm hearing that across the board in the data center space. The data centers are running white hot. In fact, this could be a problem going forward, that we're running the data so hot that if there is a failure, it'll be harder to fix failures, right? Because we're running them at capacity and struggling.
Some data centers have Winnebagos where staff is living on site because they become crucial infrastructure. And it's phenomenal when you think about how this is going to dramatically change how we see all forms of business. But when you think about the financial impact, you know, after the dust settles, of being able to pay employees to live anywhere in the world they desire, as long as they're productive, and maybe to have regional centers for corporate meetings and hangouts and things of that level. We're also seeing an increase in interactivity between employees that did not take place in the headphone culture epoch that we just lived through. I mean, this idea of exposed brick and recycled wood offices that look so cool. Everybody walked around with headphones on. Nobody was talking in the hallways. Nobody was interacting for a lot of reasons. And, you know, we've studied this. So now we're going to see more interactivity because you can literally hit somebody up very quickly through electronic means in a much more productive way working remotely. So these are going to be some of the impacts. And that means more income for the employees. It means more productivity and income for the companies.
It's real interesting. I bought 3 of these Facebook portal devices for my house 2-3 months ago, right, when they were brand new. And people get me about it on Twitter, right? Oh, that's a privacy device. What, you know, your privacy's going away. Why would you join Facebook? Delete Facebook, right? All this angst about Facebook. Now they're sold out because all of a sudden, shoot, we're locked at home. We can't see our family anymore. Oh, where's our family? They're not even on Zoom yet. They're on Facebook. So, I need a Facebook portal device. And then, you know, Brian and I talk about VR a lot. I'm playing a lot more VR now. VR is a great way to get exercise. It's a great way to get training on certain things. And it's a great way to escape and get some stress relief and some mental illness satisfaction.
Absolutely. Right?
That's the book I wrote. I just finished a book that'll be out in May that Irina Cronin and I wrote. And that's what we cover, is all this new technology that isn't quite ready yet. VR, only, you know, Facebook has sold 700,000 Oculus Quests, and you can't even buy one because the supply chain is sort of messed up right now, right? And it's just not ready for the mainstream. So we should split, you know, Zoom is happening right now. It's being adopted by many, millions and millions and millions of people every day, right? VR and AR are things that are gonna come for the next one.
Correct.
You know, and there are going to be things that come next year. You're going to see Facebook and Apple come out with new devices. And those devices, I think, are the ones that are going to really be adopted by the mainstream, or more accurately, the people who have any wealth left, after this thing.
Isn't that interesting how rapidly it really shows the fragility of capitalism? Oh, yeah. You know, because within 2 weeks, where, you know, the world's largest economy, you know, with trillions of dollars of GDP, is having to bail out the average Joe just so they can get food to eat. We're not even talking about paying rents and mortgages and things like that. You know, that's how sensitive this system was to this collapse.
And we're gonna have a bigger problem soon because
you know, it's not just that. It is a cascade that is going through the economy. The entire infrastructure of what we considered the pre-2020 pandemic economy is gone. Venture capitalists that we knew of before this pandemic are going to be wiped out. A lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them. I just put out a tweet today that the Small Business Administration is not looking at giving bailout funds to venture capitalist-based startups because the VC would be considered an employer, and if they have over 500 employees, they're not part of the SBA program as it exists today. That's an interpretation. I'm not a lawyer. Wow. And that might very well change by the time the show comes out.
I have a call-in
with my contact at the SBA. Those funds are critical for the restaurant industry primarily, but certainly every other industry. The restaurant industry is going to completely remake itself. You're going to see a lot of less reliance on third parties to deliver and more reliance on local restaurants having the servers deliver. And a lot of people think this is contrarian, but it's very logical. You create a brand by not only the restaurant's food, but the environment. If more people are staying home, the environment is an extension through that server. And the server, you know, the servers that are going out making these deliveries, they're talking with the people that are buying the food, they're interacting with them, and they're extending the brand of that restaurant. Whereas a disinterested third party has no investment in that brand, and it ultimately will make that brand more generic. So I'm predicting, and I'm already seeing these restaurants taking hold of their own technology stack and taking those deliveries directly. And this would have been considered a charlatan and heretical just to bring up 3 weeks ago. And now it's happening in real time.
Brian, there's a restaurant in South Lake Tahoe that I know about where the owners of the restaurant give their employees a choice. You can come and work for us, or you can go home and collect unemployment or something. But they put the employees all in one house to sequester them from the public and from the disease. They are also very strict. So they built a whole protocol about how to disinfect the food that comes into their restaurant and how to separate themselves from customer and how to collect money and how to hand off goods. So they're staying open and they are fairly reasonably sure that they're not passing out virus to their customers. Well, think about what that's doing for their brand right now. It's starting to take off. First of all, the two restaurants on both sides of them closed and didn't even try to stay open, right? They're delivering food. They have food delivery and pickup. So you can drive by on the street and pick up some food from them. So they're staying open. Number two, if they're correct and they don't give anybody the virus and they don't get it themselves, they're going to build a brand that says this is a really innovative new restaurant that served the community and did what it took to survive in this time. And they're going to.
These are important points. And bankers are going to do the same thing. Innovative bankers right now are doing amazing things to be able to get mortgages done. Car sales are being innovated beyond Tesla. I just had a friend who bought a new pickup truck. He's in the middle of nowhere and obviously couldn't go to an auto dealer. But the auto dealer, obviously, the entire auto industry is being pummeled at this point. He was able to get an incredible deal on a pickup truck, got a loan, and did it all electronically in a space of 7 minutes. So there's no boiler room for the potential victim during a normal auto sale. So we're seeing these old line type of businesses transformed because of this event, and I think a lot of them are going to wind up sticking in this way. Now, are public restaurants going to exist post 2020 pandemic? Absolutely, sure. Of course. We're gonna get together. We're gonna hang out, clubs, but there are going to be reasonable measures being taken. This is going to be the generation that's going to remember what a pandemic looks like. And when you track 1918, 1919. It really was not an accident that the Roaring Twenties came out of that pandemic period. A lot of it was pent-up technologies from, obviously, World War One, also, but also that pent-up demand to connect with people. People had access to telephones and radios in 1919 and 1918. They just didn't see a need for it. Post-pandemic, there was an explosion of these technologies to interconnect people because they wanted to be able to be, you know, with other people electronically. And this goes to what Robert has been saying about VR for a long time, and you, Brett, also, 10 years ago almost, that these technologies are going to interconnect people in new ways. They're not going to replace everything, but they're going to replace some of the mundane things that people were doing, especially in the banking realm. I think if a bank is not set up for voice and VR at this point, they're not ready for the next decade because are going to meet with bankers through virtual environments.
Let's talk about one bank. My friend works at JP Morgan. He said during a normal year, like last year, if you wanted to get a new technology adopted by their 300,000 employees, it would have taken more than a year to do.
Yeah.
And last week alone, they onboarded 115,000 people onto Zoom, right? In 1 week, right? So think about what that means for the bank. Now all of a sudden, everybody at the bank is connected with Zoom and can make decisions in this new decentralized way and start thinking about how to serve customers in a new way. Because now everybody at the bank is on Zoom, so why not have the customer on Zoom? Right.
Exactly. And when we think about decentralizations in banks, we're also talking about decentralization in currency. This bill that was passed, a lot of people didn't see what happened. But inside that bill is the ability for the government to create electronic cash. And, you know, there's a lot of details that are still being worked out, but it is a tremendous shift. Now, I don't think it's going to be done fast enough to distribute funds to Americans in need. But it's very possible that it could be done if this extends out as long as some people have extended it.
One of the things Jen Tesha from Financial Health Network Rose put on the public profile was actually, you know, part of the problem with this whole bailout is they're thinking of sending these $1,200 payments as checks to people. You know, and people who, you know, they don't have bank accounts. Like 20% of American households, the poorest American households, don't have bank accounts. So getting a check today, you know, what use is that to you? You can't go to a check cashier and get it converted into cash. Exactly. Yeah. So we need some, there's some fundamental changes. But as you both pointed out, part of the realization, the awakening that's happening with digital is these organizations that have resisted it because of the momentum or inertia around the existing systems who are now forced to do it are suddenly going, hey, it works. And guess what? It's actually cheaper than the way we were doing business before. And so I think this is going to, you know, radically change the economics of many industries as well.
Back to the restaurant example, I'm not as positive that a lot of restaurants are going to survive this. I think if you look at the average Main Street in America, I did a 9,000-mile road trip a couple of years ago with my kids and went to all these small little towns. You look at Main Street, right?
The Tesla you're sitting in, right?
Oh, yeah. Of course. You know, what else are you going to do with autopilot and supercharger network, right? When you look at the average American city, and even around the world, right? Out of 10 businesses, I'm expecting 8 of them to go away. But I'm expecting the ones that survive this to grow radically big. And, you know, when I visited China, I went to a restaurant that served 800 people at one time. They had 800 tables, 800 seats in their restaurant. I think you're going to start seeing something like that, that a certain number of restaurants are going to get so efficient and have such a reliable product, and people are going to be ordering it at home. I mean, we're seeing delivery services growing 20% a week right now, right?
Oh, yeah.
hiring 20% more people every week. And Amazon just said, well, we need 100,000 new people. Come and join, right?
Well, but, the thing about all industries is that I think there is not going to be a business that isn't untouched by what we're experiencing. Medical. We're going to finally get HIPAA aligned so that doctors can do remote, you know, evaluations. And we're getting companies like Apple stepping up with a privacy-based evaluation app for COVID-19. So you have a lot of different aspects that are percolating up. But getting back to the banking scenario for a sec, the idea of being able to send cash out for the U.S. government, you know, electronically is a great idea. But there's a problem on the recipient end, and that's KYC. The biggest issue and the biggest stumbling block, know your customer. So it's a legal federal requirement.
I joke it's called kill your customers with paperwork.
Kill your customer. Yeah, so you know what I mean. So how do you get, let's call it the least banked or underbanked, how do you get them cash?
So this,
you can't just send them a gift card because that gift card will wind up in the wrong hands. So what is the impetus that allows KYC to work? And unfortunately or fortunately, it's according to how you want to see this, is a universal ID system.
Absolutely. And I was gonna say this all leads to the fact that we need better identity infrastructure, because you can't have a digital presence unless there's a uniform, universal identity infrastructure that's there. And the social security number is not robust enough to be safe anymore, right?
No, it's useless. How does one do this in a very rapid way? And you know, I talked to some people inside of government. This is like a shift. They're finally starting to take blockchain very, very seriously as a way to not only, you know, identify funds availability on a decentralized, robust level, right? So you can see anywhere in the world that you have funds available. Right? Because in a sense, this is a jump start for universal basic income, perhaps, maybe not, maybe some other form. But you need to be able to identify that person in a robust environment. And blockchain does that in a very unique way. So, and that can be ramped up in a very rapid fashion.
This is something I'm watching really closely. China tamped down the virus pretty effectively because they do a lot of centralized surveillance, right? Everybody has an app that tracks their movement. Everybody is being watched with face recognition in the street. Everybody is having to sign in when they go into a grocery store or into a business and have their temperature scanned, which is validated with their app. It's sort of like they built an Amazon Go for the entire society, right?
Yeah.
And when you start thinking about doing that in America, I wonder how likely that is to happen anytime soon, because we have a lot of resistance to that for a whole lot of reasons. We have freedom of speech. We're scared of having the central government watching everything we do. We don't want that kind of privacy, and we don't like it. Yet.
Having said that, that is one factor that could have dramatically reduced the impact of this coronavirus. Even more a critical thing, Robert, was compliance with government instructions, right? Like when you look at Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, and these sort of things, South Korea, Germany, one of the reasons they have much lower fatalities and much lower caseload is people followed the instructions of the government to the letter. There was no one saying, I don't believe this is real, I'm going to go out to the park on the weekend because...
Oh, then you go to spring break in Hong Kong?
Exactly, yeah. that compliance with government instructions, this is sort of really, I wanted to get to this with you guys, is this fascination or this defense of the individual rights over the collective rights of people has really bitten us in the backside here.
Yes. How fast are we going to change our belief? And here's, I think there's going to be an American model of surveillance that's different from the Chinese model. The Chinese model is very centralized, a camera on every street corner, and everybody is instrumented. Everybody has to check in. Everybody has to take their temperature. Everybody has to look at the app before they leave the house, right? Everybody has to check in at the grocery store. That's probably not going to happen. For a whole lot of reasons. One, we don't have the kind of money that we need to put that kind of system in place anytime soon. The thing that's going to be interesting is Apple has a pair of glasses ready to manufacture, and in the front of those glasses are going to have 6 bays for sensors, right? So what if Apple came out with a pair of glasses next year and said, hey, you can walk into a grocery store and see if anybody has a fever? I would buy a pair of those glasses so fast your head would spin. And they don't need to report to the central government that that checkout counter clerk has a fever. I just need to go up to the manager. Why are you letting that employee work on your counter? She or he has a fever, right?
And so there's a whole series of sensors, though, right, Robert? Right. We can not only just do temperature. We can do the CMF, a flow of air through an area. If it's stagnant air, there's a good chance that there's a collection of other particulates. You can analyze some of these particulates within these glasses. You can analyze your own quantitative self to see how you're responding to the environment way before you show obvious symptoms. So you can actually telegraph this stuff with permission and HIPAA compliance and privacy to a doctor. So these mediations can be individualized, but still used in some form centrally to help governments and health agencies say, oh, we have a breakout in the middle of Central Park right now. Everybody that was in Central Park voluntarily, quarantine. And if you don't, unfortunately, it goes down to the next level of escalation. So you can actually start doing things like that. And you can do it in a non-dystopian sense. And you can do it in a sense that's not against American ideals, if you will. Yeah. But it requires a new social contract. It requires new thinking. It requires a whole new revitalization of what we think government is, which I think is going to happen. Whether we like it or not, whether we want it or not, the government's going to be realigned and reestablished. And so is the entire financial system. So is the way that we invest in companies. You know, I had this idea of the greenback coming back as a way for individuals of any country to own shares in the government, in the sense that the economy of that dollar, of that currency, rises and falls by the productivity of the entire country.
Okay, well, let me jump in there. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We're going to go to a quick ad break, and right after the ad break, we will be back with Robert Scoble and Brian Romley talking about how coronavirus has changed the way we use technology and has changed our behavior. We'll be right back after these words from our phenomenal sponsors. Hey guys, this is Brett King from Breaking Banks. You may or may not know, but Provoke Media, the parent company of Breaking Banks, runs a range of different podcasts, and many of them are focused right now on the coronavirus impact and the trends happening around us as a result of that. Check out these comments from Ron Shevlin on the recent Finovate podcast hosted by Greg Palmer.
Number one has got to be about stability, stabilizing your customers or members' financial lives, stabilizing your employees' financials and personal lives.
So don't forget to go to provoke.fm and check out the other Provoke Media podcasts. We've got Breaking Banks, Breaking Banks Europe, Breaking Banks Asia, Serial Entrepreneur, FinTech 5, Tech on Reg, and the Finovate podcast. Check them out at provoke.fm. We are back from the break on Breaking Banks. And prior to the break, we had Robert Scoble and Brian Romley talking with us about the impact of coronavirus, COVID-19, on the way we're behaving and technologies and the economy in general. So, Robert, you were about to sort of get into some of the deeper economic elements of sort of how the Fed's responding to this and how you think where this is going to go.
I'm starting to see a lot of demand issues. if you travel America and study where people work other than offices, it's car factories or plane factories. Well, nobody's buying a plane right now because travel is zero. And nobody's buying a car right now because car travel is zero or near zero. And even if an all clear gets called in 2 or 3 months, I don't think those things are going to come back really quickly. And in some areas, you're going to see really depressed neighborhoods where the housing values, like in Las Vegas, Las Vegas is a place that lives off tourism. It's almost wholly tourism. And So you start thinking, well, if people don't go to Vegas because they don't have any money for a vacation, that's going to be a problem. And The conference has just been decimated and is not going to come back quickly. I mean, Tim O'Reilly Publications just canceled all of their physical events and just fired 75 workers. And they're not alone, right? The conference business is not going to come back real quick. And keep in mind, we might not be in an all clear for a year until a vaccine comes out, or a year and a half, right? And so people might be really skittish about going to.
Well, you guys have seen me say this on Twitter. You've seen me say it on Facebook. I'm sure that I think that the only way we get to back to a new normal is effectively like, you know, when you're traveling through Africa today and you need to carry a yellow fever certificate to show you're vaccinated for yellow fever, you're going to have to carry some sort of medical document. It could be on your phone, of course, in your medical ID with Apple, showing that you're immune to the coronavirus. You've got it, you tested with anybody's.
My former boss already has had it and has survived, right? So he is going to get one of these cards, but nobody in his family is going to have a card, and none of his coworkers are going to have a card.
Unless they're tested for the antibodies. Maybe they had it and they didn't realize they had it, because a lot of people are asymptomatic, right? So
my point is, out of a family group, only a couple of family members are going to have it. So let's say we want to go to Las Vegas and go for a vacation. Who is going to come with us, even if you have the card?
They're going to have the vaccine. And that's, as you say, that could be a year away.
A year and a year and a half away. And then who has the wealth to go to Vegas for a week?
That's true.
Yeah. And, you know, if you look at what happened in 1918, 1919, there was never a vaccine and there was never any treatment other than Vicks vapor rub. Vicks vapor rub was the protocol that they were using on folks. Now, that decimated hopefully a lot more folks was decimated in that period, in that epoch, than we will see. So what happened when you really look at it? Essentially, what happens to all viruses, the virus wants the host to survive. So ultimately, viruses normalize. You don't so much get an immunity to it as versions of that virus mutate. And we already have, I think, 9 versions of mutations of this particular virus. It mutates to a less severe form to the point that everybody in the population has it. Basically, everybody has Spanish flu that mutated from 1918, 1919, more or less, in their system. We have these virus loads all the time. So that's the other element of it. Unfortunately, that takes a time. That takes a long time. You know, a lot of people lost their lives to become...
You're talking about herd immunity, right?
It's not so much immunity as because you don't become immune to the virus. The virus actually wants the host to survive. It doesn't want to kill the host. It, quote unquote, wants. It's really just evolution. If the host dies too quickly, then the virus doesn't spread and therefore it doesn't continue. A good virus, according to a virus outlook of the world, would be, I want somebody to get it, get sneezy and sniffly and runny nose, send it out as long and as far as and as wide as possible, and then get well to live again to transfer another virus. I mean, that's kind of what happens. So these viruses actually mutate themselves because of the unfortunate bad version of the virus killing the host. Now, I'm not a scientist. I got no initials next to my last name or my first name. I've just been studying this stuff for many decades, not just particularly this subject, but any type of scientific study. And when you start looking at what happens, is you realize that we don't necessarily need something to save us other than really good behavior. and that kind of behavior is make common sense. Don't interact with people that are ill if you don't need to. Medical workers should be taken care of immediately. I really believe the 1918 gas mask is probably the most proper facial mask for a medical worker today, and it probably will wind up being discovered. They actually use those face masks in emergency environments at hospitals, and it saved a lot of doctors' lives. The cloth face mask did nothing, and we're going to find out the viruses can pass through most of these. Cloth masks.
By the way, and I've been watching scientists and doctors, the cloth face masks are great for citizens to wear to the grocery store. Because
sure.
If you're asymptomatic and you sneeze, if you sneeze into a mask, your cloud of particles, of bubbles of this virus,
they're minimized.
Right, so you're not making everybody else sick.
That again, that's Hong Kong, right? That's the lesson Hong Kong learned from SARS.
Exactly.
I lived in Hong Kong through SARS, so I can talk to.
So, what's your experience, Brett? You've actually been to ground zero on one of these things. What are the things that maybe we don't know about?
Well, everyone wears a mask in public, and it's not to protect themselves necessarily from the virus. There is that, but it's also to ensure that if they have it and they don't know, they're not spreading it. Secondly, every major building you go into, every grocery store you go into, there's someone standing at the front of the grocery store with a thermometer, digital thermometer, or temperature sensor to check if you've got a fever, and you're not allowed in the building if you've got a fever. On all the lifts, on any surface where you have to push a button or something like that, they will have a clear film over it that's embedded with antiseptics or whatever to kill the germs. And every 15 minutes, they're wiping down common surfaces every 15 major buildings. So these are the things that are happening as a course of everyday life in Hong Kong. And you want to know why their viral spread is so low. It's because of that discipline, right, that they learned during SARS. And it's been super effective.
And the QR code actually, Brett, came up much more prominently during that period because it's a non-contact sort of environment. Is that correct?
In Hong Kong, they had the Octopus card. This predated Google Wallet and so forth. And so the Octopus card, which was used as the Metro card,
gotcha,
was used as this primary form of contactless payments. And so, you know, people were using this extensively during SARS. Yeah.
I want to go back, though, to what's going to happen to housing and car prices.
Let's talk about that.
There's a real demand problem. And when there's, you know, I'm an economics minor, right? And we learn about supply and demand as the basic principle of economics, right? When demand falls and supply remains the same, your prices fall. So we're going to have massive deflation. Well, what happens if there's massive deflation in housing or real estate, commercial real estate? We're going to have banks fail because they're going to have to take over those loans and they're going to lose a lot of money.
Commercial real estate is going to get hammered, man.
Yeah.
Well, I talked to a guy yesterday who wrote a book about deflation, Jeff Booth, and he's predicting that the Fed is going to artificially print money, do quantitative easing and other things. He predicts they're going to put $15 trillion into the economy in fake money, right? which is going to be done to keep the housing prices from falling that much and to keep the stock market from crashing and to keep a run on the bank from happening, which is going to cause all sorts of weird things in the economy. One, we might get deflation for a bit. Housing values will go down a little bit, and then they're going to race up because of inflation, right? And so I'm starting to think, What does this mean? What is the monetary policy that the government is trying to do right now going to mean for us long term?
So I'm trying to sort of tackle a little bit of this in techno-socialism, which I'm having to rewrite as a result of coronavirus.
Figured it.
You know, like things where I spent an entire chapter arguing on the merits of universal basic income and why we might have to do it. And now suddenly coronavirus is like, you know, produced this response, you know, in weeks, you know. So if you're on the conservative side of government right now, you're not going to come back after this and say that giving people a payout is socialism anymore, right? It's sort of really hard to have that argument when the entire United States is... As pushed us towards that. But there are elements around the debt angle of this that are really interesting.
Yeah.
To consider. So all these countries are incurring massive debt right now. So, you know, there's a possibility of, you know, sort of a global movement to forgive debt at the national federal level. But
I think it's very likely, Brett. I think at the very least, you're going to see consumer debt forgiveness on mortgages. I'm almost certain of that. I don't see how it can play out otherwise.
No. But I think there's another element of this that could be quite interesting. Imagine if governments say, look, we've all got this debt. We've all got this massive debt that we've incurred with each other. And, you know, we've got this new social awareness or consciousness as a result of this pandemic. So we'll forgive debt if you put it into social causes like ensuring that this pandemic won't happen again or mitigating climate change risk. So you can get your debt forgiven, but only if you commit it to these sort of social programs.
Let's talk about climate change. Because if Brian told me on January 1st, you know, they're going to shut down all the world's economies by the end of March, and they're going to start taking pictures of the air and the water and the climate and
lower emissions and everything. Yep.
But we're going to have the science that's being collected right now will be studied for 40 to 60 years, in a couple ways. One, we're going to see the real harm that our economic activity is doing to the environment.
Correct.
So we're going to know which factories are really polluting the earth and what cost that is really causing, right? We're going to have a really great picture of that. There's not going to be any argument in 2 years about what our economic activity is doing to the environment. The scientists are going to know and are going to know pretty damn exactly because of this period of time. The other thing is everybody is staying home right now. So the satellites are taking pictures of us right now of our homes and is going to know which homes are leaking heat into the air at a higher rate than other homes. So now if there's a stimulus, if there was a rational government, which is a big, big if, right? But if there was a rational government coming out of this thing, I can see one of the stimulus would be, we need to make our homes more efficient. We need to stop putting carbon in the air. We need to stop leaking heat into the air from our homes. So here's a picture of every home that has, you know, more than 20% leakage. So do a new infrastructure bill.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's put solar on those homes. Let's go put new insulation in those homes. Let's replace the windows in those homes, right?
And let's figure out where to place battery storage so that neighborhoods and boroughs are...
Exactly.
We could have all sorts of new things to do to fix climate coming out of there.
A lot of the ways you can brainstorm this is you look at any type of system and you say, if we were to recreate this system today, what would it look like? And I think we're going to have a lot of those thoughts that are going to come across almost every industry, from medical to finance to business to how people live. I mean, we've learned one thing, and that is whether we like globalization of manufacturing or not, we do need each country to create their own environment for at least medical supplies, for at least vaccinations, for at least antibiotics, because you can never ever guarantee a supply chain of a few thousand miles is always going to work. And thus is true about food production. We really need to, this is part of my hyperlocal thesis, is that we really need to understand where is food coming from. And how can we support that on a local and intermediate state level? And what to do with that surplus and how to distribute it? I think if we start thinking in a great global sense and a hyper-local sense, we're at the beginning, the precipice of trying to understand how to move past where we are today.
So let me,
the only way we can really move forward.
So Brian, I'd like your comments on this based on, you know, your unique perspective to look at this from a historical point of view. one of the things that has really hurt us in economies like Australia, the United States, and the UK is people asserting their individual rights to be able to go out and spread the virus, essentially, right? And yeah. So there's obviously a growing collective awareness. There's still some people who are denying this is real, that think it's fake news. I don't know whether you guys have seen, but there is this global movement right now of people going around and covertly entering hospitals to see if people are really at hospitals and hospitals are really being overwhelmed.
Wow.
Insane. It's insane. Wow. Right? Because they just don't believe it's real, you know? And so this disbelief.
Didn't go to the moon and
I get that, Robert, but this but you know we have seen you know part of the problem is like if this had happened in the 1980s, right, and the television cable news and the newspapers are telling you must stay home, I suspect we would have been more compliant even here in the United States and my home country of Australia. But I think because of all of the fake news and because of the fact that everyone's an expert and now you can have an epidemiologist on talking about how this virus moves and someone else who runs this conspiracy channel is getting equal airtime saying this isn't real, this is the government preparing to introduce global government and that this is the Illuminati's mechanism to introduce this. These people are getting equal airtime, and so that's part of the thing we're having to filter. But my point is this.
Murdoch comes a lot.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, if you look at again the climate change thing, I make this point in techno-socialism. If you look at the three economies where they held out the longest on denial of climate change, were all Murdoch dominant media nations. So Australia, US, and the UK. Now, putting that aside, we've got this burgeoning social awareness, this connectivity. As you said, Brian, after the Spanish flu, the Roaring Twenties came out of that. So this social collectivism, this view of we're all in this together and we need to work better together as a species, no longer separated by those national boundaries. How do you think that could be born out of this? Or do you think it could be born out of this?
That's a great question, Brett, and I've been thinking a lot about that and reading a lot of science fiction and going back into the 30s and 40s, a lot of Asimov, Highland, and things of that nature. And when you come back out of it, it's always been something that's galvanized humanity to a common enemy, right? And whenever there's been massive social change, and unfortunately, it's been world wars, it's been pandemics and plagues and things of that level. I mean, we can even look at 1616. It's a lot less easier to get press clippings from that era, but you can read some of the things that took place. There is a galvanizing spirit that comes out of this. And it's very important not to play it the wrong way from people in politics. You can't really make this a Republican, a Democrat, a liberal, or a conservative type of thing. You have to make it a humanity thing. And it's not a repackaging of somebody's old style of thinking, because I think all of these systems that humanity's experienced to some form of or another have been corrupted to a level where I think it's been repudiated. Right. So we can always point to one system that has some kind of thing going wrong. Right. What we can do now is start looking at what if we were to reinvent how humanity lives today.
Exactly.
Using this technology. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Because,
and
this
now we have this
is ultimately this is ultimately a systemic failure.
It is.
The system failed.
It is.
Right. When it should have protected us, we have people dying because they can't get on ventilators because hospitals are over capacity. It's a systemic failure.
Exactly. And we're going to analyze how are we going to deal with medical costs. If we have longevity in society, which I think we all accept that we should, then we have to look at how do we make people productive. You know, I don't ever hope to retire. I don't even understand what retirement means. And I have friends that are working in their 90s and they love it. They're in love with their life. So we have to start thinking about what does retirement look like? How are people going to live? And in fact, if we are in this world that you've written about, Robert and Brett, you've written about before, if we're in this world where we're doing less work, quote unquote, and we have machines and technology doing our work, how do we revitalize people's lives to make them useful in their own mind and useful into the greater mind of society? These are things that we really need to have to start unpacking right now, because this post-2020 pandemic is going to align us in this direction, whether we like it or not, because it's never going to go back to the way it was before. It can't.
There were some fundamental shifts happening anyways before the virus hit. The virus just sped everything up 1,000 times.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Turbo mode.
I live pretty close to the Tesla factory is a good example of this. I went to the Tesla factory 18 months ago, and I went to it last year about 4 months ago. And there was 20% more robots in that factory from year to year. So you take that 5 years forward, and the whole thing's robots. So 10,000 people aren't working on a factory anymore. They're building the robots and running the robots, right? There are jobs, there's just a lot fewer of them. I met a guy at the game developer conference last year who bragged to me, I work for a supply chain company and we just turned on our first completely automated cold storage warehouse, which means someone comes in one door on a truck, a robot unpacks the truck, moves the salad around to another truck that goes to Chicago and another one that goes to Miami and another one that goes to New York. And it's completely automated, no people in there. So how many people used to do that? 400? 100?
Easily,
Some number of people who were moving things around a warehouse before. Now they're not. So these trends were happening already, and now they're going to be sped up because those factories are getting closed and inefficient things are going to go out of business because the world is going to efficiency. Amazon is going to be stronger coming out of this than they went into it, right? Why? Because we're buying everything online all of a sudden. We're not going to Macy's anymore. Macy's is struggling financially now to deal with this. They just furloughed most of their workers.
Yeah, right? Almost all of them are gone. Yeah.
Amazon, on the other hand, is hiring 100,000.
All right. So let's get down to the sort of stuff, you know, you've been talking about, Robert, spatial computing and so forth, but also let's jump into
this is spatial computing. Robots are spatial computing because they move around computing. Autonomous cars are spatial computing. And these new augmented reality glasses that are going to come soon, and VR as well. VR is here already, but very few people have it. And that's computing you move around because no longer are you looking at a flat 2D screen. You're moving around. The computing is all over around you, right? That's spatial computing.
So that's one part of it. You talked about tracking us and having tracking algorithms and things like that.
If you're moving around and the computing is tracking you, that's spatial, right?
Right. And I've been talking about ingestibles and wearables that track your biometrics and so forth. But let's look out 5-10 years. You know, we've always thought smart glasses would be 2025 or thereabouts, maybe a bit earlier in terms of mainstream.
Maybe a little earlier now, but it's going to take a little bit of time. First of all, nobody has any wealth right now, so
Right.
If Apple comes out with a $2,000 pair of glasses, I'll still buy one because I still have a little wealth. there's many, many people who all of a sudden don't have that kind of money, right? Now, does Apple say, well, you'll get a job with these and you'll be able to finance them and you'll get a deal? Sure, they can play all sorts of games. They have so much money to do.
But how is that tech going to be used post-coronavirus?
Let's walk through the 7 industries, all right? Education. I can teach you. In fact, the researchers that are studying the virus are studying it in VR right now and looking for attach points of the virus. How does that virus hook onto things? How does it evolve? And they're looking at that in 3D, in VR with teams, and they're talking about it with teams of scientists and looking at the latest science that's coming out. So education is going to see radical changes when this new world appears, right? The AR, VR world. And it's starting to in classrooms. You look at transportation. You know, 10 years from now, I doubt we're going to buy a car, or very few of us are going to buy a car. Maybe only the super rich who want to, you know, the bragging rights of owning a car.
Yeah, but my most car's not much use today.
Right. And the car I'm sitting in is costing me $2 an hour right now, when you look at all the costs it is.
Yeah.
And so why, if there's an autonomous technology, why are we even buying a car? Let's send our car back on the road and have it do work and go pick up other people, go pick up things, go pick up dinner, right? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So transportation is about to radically change in the next decade. You look at manufacturing, we already covered some of the robots that are happening. We're seeing new kinds of robots because of spatial computing technology. Used to be robots were in big cages and they did heavy jobs, right? And you still see those. If you visit the Tesla line, they have a couple of robots that lift the car up and put it on another line. Well, those are big-ass robots, and they're in cages. Humans don't get close to them. But there's a whole lot of new, what they call cobots, robots that work with the humans, right next to the humans, and can sense the human and sense the human handing the robot something.
Yeah, I was in the Huawei factory in Shenzhen in January, and they had these robots that come and wait for people to stack the finished phones into the box or stack certain components into the box. And once that's done, the robot trundles off and delivers it to another line.
Exactly my point, right? There's all sorts of new robot technology that's coming along and new kinds of techniques. Volkswagen virtualized its entire factory line. They call it digital twinning. And they turn the factory into a digital twin, a virtual copy of the real thing. And they did that for design. So when they need to design a new factory to do a new car line, they design that all virtually in VR. And they think through, you know, where can this machine fit? Who's going to work on it? What does the job look like? And they do all that virtually now. They don't build the line anymore and then train people. You get trained virtually in VR before you even get to go on the factory line, right? So you're being trained.
Hey, so listen, guys, we need to wrap it up.
Go on and on,
I know.
Right?
We always do this. We always do this.
Retail is going to change, right? Why do you want to go in and touch things in a retail store?
Yeah,
why don't you have it delivered or have an Amazon Go kind of thing where you just go in and pick up the things you want and walk out? You don't touch anything, and it charges you, right?
Oh, contactless and you know, cashierless is absolutely going to happen.
Endless.
For sure. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, it's great to have you guys on. Just as we leave, let me ask you this question. As you personally come out of this, have you had a single aha moment that's been most impactful for you personally?
Dealing with the mentality of crushing, devastating despair is one of the main things you have to deal with first. Because if you can't get over your fear or your despair, you're not going to be very creative and not very useful to anybody. So
mental health,
virtual really reality, cool. Going for walks and exercise, taking time, you know, to get your mind back in the game after having real losses is really tough. And you should look at some of the spiritual leaders that are helping you build your mind back so that you can be part of the solution coming out of this and not part of the problem.
Brian?
I gotta echo what Robert said. It's brilliant. It's poetic. You know, we are going to deal with mental health issues that are going to be, you know, profound. And the folks listening to us right now, it's time to develop your inner core if you haven't. And there's ways to do that. You need to find those ways. And there is going to be a sunny day on the other side of this. And it's not painting a smiley face on a bad situation. There's going to be travesties that are going to take place. There's going to be horrific things that are going to take place. But what you can do to help is to unleash your creativity and look at the things that you can do and you can help enact that can change the world. And these are the moments to do it. And, you know, personally, my aha moments was just to and I've been doing this for a while, but I just keep reinvesting it. And that is to really honor the things that are important to you. Love the things that you love. Let those people that you know that you love them, because you know, we're only given a moment. We don't have tomorrow, and we didn't have yesterday. I mean, these things just happen, and you just have this moment, right? So you have to live your life that way. And this is the reminder. So that's awesome. The aha moment.
Well, you guys, appreciate your continuity through all of this, and I count you as very valuable friends, and I thank you for helping us all through this, and thanks for being back on Breaking Banks radio show again.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks for having us. It's awesome as always.
Awesome. That's it for Breaking Banks. We'll see you guys next week with more on how we're coping and how we'll get to a new normal amongst the COVID-19 crisis. See you next week.
That's it for this week. Thanks to our guests and to our sponsors who help make the show possible. You may have a little more time on your hands right now, so you can listen to all of our more than 300 shows, plus episodes from all of our other shows, including Breaking Banks Europe, Tech on Reg, the Finovate podcast, and more, all on Provoke.fm. I hope you like them, and if so, that you'll give all the shows 5 stars and share them with others. Stay home if you can, take care of your loved ones, and let's all work together to move this industry forward and to make it stronger than ever. That's it for this week. We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.